Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Litigation Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, March 24, 2017, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call, as today we discuss deep pocket jurisprudence and meaningful civil justice reform. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion on our call today are those of the expert. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. I'm very pleased to welcome a return guest to our Teleforum conference call series. He's Victor E. Schwartz. He's a partner at the Washington, D.C., Shook, Hardy & Bacon law offices. He is an expert in these areas, having practiced in this area for decades. He's going to begin with 10 to 12 minutes or so of opening remarks, but as always, we'll be looking to the audience for questions, so please have those in mind for when we get to that portion of the program. With that, Victor Schwartz, the floor is yours.
Hey, thank you. Dean, thank you so much for including me. The Federalist Society does terrific work. I think of them as guardians of the law, and that is a big role. And both topics that I'm going to talk about today really fit within the guardhouse of the Federalist Society. And in part, it's based on my practice experience. But as Dean knows, I was an academic. I still do this casebook, Prosser, Wade, and Schwartz. So it's a little combination. And I'm going to begin with something that is surprising in its possibilities, and that is federal civil justice reform. It's been over a decade since any federal civil justice reform was enacted. That was the Class Action Fairness Act, which really put class actions that are interstate in federal courts, signed by President Bush. But the past 10 years, anything that business wanted was absolutely dead because under Harry Reid, nothing that the trial lawyers opposed would ever become law. But Harry Reid is gone. And while the new leader of the Senate is not exactly a conservative tort reform person, he did vote for the Class Action Fairness Act of 2005, as did the new chair of the Judiciary, I mean now ranking of the Judiciary Committee, Dianne Feinstein. So that's a little bit about background. The reason I wanted to talk to you today is because all of a sudden, federal civil justice reform, state civil justice reform, has become more important than usual. And this is why. This is not written down anywhere. It's just based on my life's experience. Right now, the word that one hears in Washington is deregulation. I was at the Heritage last week, and they were all talking and happy and glowing about deregulation. And probably it's a good idea to have some deregulation. There's another side to that moon. When there is deregulation, look at a 40-year history, that's when tort law expands. Judges think, oh my God, the world is going to come to an end. And if I don't do something about it by expanding tort law, it will. So that's why there's a greater need for federal and state civil justice reform. And I'll just mention a little bit about the federal reforms. First, as many members of the Federalist Society agree, in general, the federal government has no business poking its nose into state tort law. It's done it when there is real strong interstate commerce needs. A bill I worked on a number of years ago, signed by President Clinton, was the Federal General Aviation Revitalization Act. It was an 18-year statute of repose for general aviation, and it saved the industry. We wrote about it about 10 years later, and we found out it produced hundreds of jobs that were 25,000 jobs that were high-paying, new safety devices were in private aircraft. All the things that Nader had predicted about planes falling out of the sky didn't happen. So that was state tort law but it was very strong on interstate commerce. In general, federal civil justice reform must affect interstate commerce and not invade states' rights. It is also much easier to address federal civil justice reform through federal procedural rules as compared to state tort law. So here are some that are right up front. These bills passed on March 9th and March 10th of this year, passed the House. In history, that's the earliest a civil justice reform has ever passed either House of Congress. Not by days, but by months. These bills were on Speaker Ryan's A Better Way. And when he put out The Better Way, he didn't just say he'd do reforms. He was very specific and detailed about what was needed. There is success. As I mentioned, the Class Action Fairness Act of 2005 worked. The General Aviation Revitalization Act worked. Here are some key bills. The first is called the Lawsuit Abuse Reduction Act, H.R. 720. We helped develop that. I called it LARA. It was developed under Bush, and I wanted to make it LARA, but I couldn't figure out a U word, so it's LARA. What does it do? Well, it helps deter frivolous claims. Now, some on the phone may not believe this, because I would find it hard to believe. Let me just share with you how the frivolous claim stop system works today. If you think you've been sued with a frivolous claim, you file what's called a Rule 11 motion. But guess where you file it? On your opponent, not on the court. And the opponent then has 21 days to decide whether he or she wants to withdraw the claim. So what do you think happens? They withdraw the claim, they put it in their word processor, and they file it again. It's a very bad rule. And LARA will get rid of that. No more free play. When you file a claim and there's going to be a Rule 11 motion, it is served with a court and no quick withdrawals. Well, let's say a judge finds a claim frivolous. And we didn't change the name, the wording for frivolous claims. It's got to be a claim that has no basis in fact and no basis in law and no basis in any reasonable extension of existing law. So when I'm at a hearing and they say, well, would this stop Brown v. Board, or would this stop voting rights decisions? No, because those were reasonable extensions of existing law. And we exempted civil rights just so we wouldn't even get into that. But if the judge determines the law is frivolous, what happens today? Today, there may be a fine, but in general, the judge keeps the money. In other words, the victim of the civil justice rampage of frivolous claims gets nothing. Under LARA, the person would get reasonable legal fees. It makes it like any other violation of law. If somebody has committed a tort, we don't say no damages. If somebody violates the Civil Rights Act, we don't say no damages. The only place where there can be a wrong and a victim and no damages today, as far as we know, is frivolous claims. So now there will be damages, and the victim would get the reasonable attorney costs he has to expend, or she. Now, it also applies, and I was speaking with Mr. Nader about this last week, to frivolous defenses. It isn't a one-way street. He was surprised to learn that, but it works both ways. That was reported out of the House on March 10th. Most of the vote was almost all party line. Few Democrats crossed over, but it almost totally a party line vote. The second bill, and I'm just going to mention three, is called the Innocent Party Protection Act, H.R. 725. And it used to be called the Fraudulent Joinder Prevention Act. But we were told by folks on the Hill, nobody knew what fraudulent joinder was. So they now call it the Innocent Party Protection Act. What does that do? Well, it's a little bit legal, but this is the way it is. I was talking to a senator, a Democrat, about things in his state, and I said, in your state, let's say a plaintiff sues a big drug company, Pfizer, Lilly, GSK, sues them. What they often do is name a local small business in your state, a pharmacy. If they sued 3M, they may name a local stationery store, even though they have no intent at all of persecuting or prosecuting a claim against that small business. The only reason they're naming it is because they want to get in state court, in a judicial hellhole, and out of federal court. And as many of you know, to get in a federal court with a tort case, $75,000 must be an issue, and all the plaintiffs and all of the defendants have to be from different states. So if you name a local business, that ousts the federal court of jurisdiction. The Innocent Party Protection Act provides guidelines for a court to find that a joinder is frivolous. Joining that stationery store, that pharmacy, is frivolous. And it says that the plaintiff has to show that the claim is plausible, a word federal courts have gotten to know. And we actually have a case from the Fifth Circuit. It's called International Energy, 818 Fed 3rd 193, decided just last year, that says the claim against the local party must be shown to be plausible. In other circuits, though, the standard is almost impossible to fulfill because it's an impossible standard. The defendant has to show that it's impossible that a judgment would ever be rendered against the local business. Well, that will never happen. So that's what we think is needed to stop. And we're on the side of the angels on this one. How can somebody be for fraudulent joinder? And that passed the House on March 9th, again, along a party line vote. The third and final bill is called the Fairness in Class Action Litigation Act. The earlier one was called the Fairness in Class Action Act. This has the word litigation and is H.R. 985. I'm just going to mention a few things that it does. Right now, when there's class actions, plaintiff lawyers sometimes have as the lead plaintiffs somebody who actually might have a harm. They bought a washing machine, or they bought a bag of potato chips that said natural. This may be about five people, often friends of the plaintiff's lawyer. But then they bring in the class action 100,000 people who may never have even bought the product. They may never have seen the ad. We call that empty suit litigation. And I wrote about it in 80 Brooklyn Law Review 599. Empty suit litigation is where a person isn't injured, but by manipulation of the system, some class actions are brought. What would the Fairness in Class Action Lawsuit Action Litigation Act do? Well, it would say that class actions have to have class members with the same type and scope of injury as the plaintiff. So if you have a lead plaintiff who has suffered an actual injury, and 100,000 people who didn't, they can't be in the same class action. Now, this has been misunderstood by some of the opponents of this, who claim that we're banning class actions. No, we're not banning them. We're just saying they really have to follow the spirit of the current federal rules and include people with the same or similar injury. You can't put the apples of injured people and the bananas of people who are not injured together. A second point of this bill I think is really good, and it's a good one to talk to a cab driver about, a waiter about, citizens who are blue-collar, have hard jobs. Everybody has received these class action notices, and we often toss them in the wastebasket, but unless we write back we don't want to be a member of the class, we're in. Then maybe a few years later, we get a little thing that says, you won. But it's $5 or $2.50 or maybe even a coupon, and we don't do anything about it. So who benefits from that class action? Do the clients? Maybe not. The lawyer benefits from it. And here's the provision in this bill that I really like. I like this one. It says that class actions must benefit class members not just the attorneys who bring the action. And the attorney's fees must be based on actual awards to the class members. Now, I've had trial lawyers and consumer activists come at me at this and say it would destroy class actions. This is the worst thing. This is the Nuremberg laws. Well, maybe not, because what it does is create an incentive for attorneys to deliver for their clients. If you talk to non-class action plaintiffs' attorneys, they don't like the class action lawyers because they don't deliver, those lawyers don't deliver for their clients. The individual plaintiff's lawyer knows his client and delivers for him or her. So this would make it the same. If you are going to win a class action and you want money, your client should get the money. Now, there's an automatic appeal of class action certifications, and if there's third-party financing, it has to be disclosed. Passing the House, as all everyone on this room, everybody else on the call knows, does not mean success in the Senate. And it's real tough going in the Senate. It's going to be very hard. But it's possible. There are 9 members, and we can send out something after and list them, who are Democrats, who are in red states. They may need a business thing or two. There's going to take and will take grassroots activity. Organizations like the Institute for Legal Reform, ATRA, our companies are going to have to do their job as to why these things are important. And it's not easy because often businesses have a number of things on their agenda where the trial lawyers only have one. But the fact that I got a call from Nader, the fact that trial lawyers are meeting with me, say that they think one or maybe two of them could happen. Now, what about the administration? Well, President Obama issued SAPs, Statements of Administration Policies, against most of these bills. He said he would veto them. Mr. Trump has not indicated that he would veto them, and I don't think he will. I think we'll... Oh, one final thing. Even if they don't pass, these bills can help people in litigation because publicity is given to wrongdoing, and federal judges have power to do self-correctives. And where I learned that? From the trial lawyers. The trial lawyers have pushed a bill that they call the Sunshine Act for 25 years. It would limit protective orders, limit sealed settlements. It's never passed. But guess what? A lot of judges now limit protective orders and sealed settlements. So things at the federal level can bring about change, even though they may not be enacted into law. But now we should work to make them law. Thank you, and Dean, you may have a question or two, and we'll go to the next topic.
I do have some questions, but I also want to open the floor to questions, so maybe people can begin queuing up while I ask a question. So in a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. So I sort of should have said at the outset, I am out of the office today, and my colleague Laura Flint is sort of helping run this call, so she'll tell us periodically whether we have any questions pending. Once again, if you're in the audience, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button. So, Victor, you mentioned indicated a significant expansion of tort law, perhaps in the next 4 years or so. Can you give us some examples, or at least one example of what you're talking about there?
Sure. The first one is what I call, I trademark stuff like judicial hell holes. I call it deep pocket jurisprudence. And it's where tort law should draw the line. But this is where that occurs. It's very precise. Deep pocket jurisprudence occurs when the real wrongdoer, for some reason, can't be sued, and there is somebody with a deep pocket available. This isn't joint liability. This is where a totally innocent defendant pays the piper. An example. There are a couple of courts in this nation who have held that a branded drug company has to pay for liability for a harm caused by a generic drug, a drug made by a competitor. Why? because in my view, anyway, the competitor generic drug company cannot be sued because of a 5-4 preemption case in the United States Supreme Court that gave the generics preemption. You cannot successfully sue them. So courts have come up with thingamajig theories to make the branded company liable. I mean, another example would be with auto. A drunk driver, drunk, causes an accident. He kills two people, but he doesn't have any insurance. So the people who are the relatives of the deceased, they sued the car company. And if you study the cases, you'll see that design liability expands when the real wrongdoer can't be sued. And I ask everyone who's listening to look for these deep pocket jurisprudence cases, because we're going to publicize the heck out of them through the same means as we use judicial hells and ATRA. And just send the cases to my colleague, Carrie Silverman, which is C as in cat, Silverman, at shb.com. S as in Sam, H as in Harry, B as in boy.com. We have deep pocket jurisprudence cases in a wide variety of areas, but because of time commitments, I'm not going to go into all of them. But it's major. We have a law review article that will be out about it very soon, because it is one of the ways, Dean, that things expand. And the other area of expansion is what Robert Reich called, the former Secretary of Labor, regulation through litigation. Let's say the EPA limits regulation. Some common law judges feel this is going to be the end of the world. This is going to be the destruction of our environment. So they take an amorphous area of tort law like nuisance, stretch it way beyond its perimeters, and feel that they are the safe guardians of America. But meanwhile, tort law has been distorted. The judge is taking on the role of an administrative agency or of Congress itself, and it's serious business. And I do hope that the Federalist Society, I will work with you in every way, spotlight these things, because we have found over the years, especially with the Judicial Hellholes program, that sunlight is a great disinfectant when common law judges run wild. So I appreciate your question.
Very good. I'm thinking maybe you caught some of our listeners off guard giving out the email address, so I'm going to stall here for a second, let them get pen and paper or get to their keyboards, but ask you again if you could give out that email address.
Sure. People can send it. C as in cat, Silverman, one word, Silverman, at S as in Sam, H as in Harry, B as in boy.com.
Good.
And Carrie is the master of collecting these cases, and we will have an article about one form of it, deep pocket jurisprudence, coming out pretty soon.
I do have other questions. If you're in the audience, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button. I understand we have one caller question pending, so let's revert to our first caller, or go to our first caller now.
Hi, my name is Jed Brinton. I'm an attorney practicing in Salt Lake City at the law firm P.A. Anderson. I have a question, I guess, about the – it seems like most of the discussion so far has been on the academics – on the policy side of things, on the these changes, potential changes through legislation. But you have mentioned both your academic background and also some you mentioned a forthcoming law review article about the deep pockets litigation issue. I guess I'm curious to get your sense of where the next frontiers are in the academic realm that would overlap with the issues you've been talking about today. I know you've done a lot of academic work in your life on these issues, but I'm just curious what you see as sort of the next areas that need to be explored by academics, if there are folks with academic interest in the audience that need to be sort of more discussed and developed in that academic realm.
I think the academics, some of them, are looking at new technologies. For example, driverless cars. Who is going to be liable if it's a driverless car? manufacturer, computer, the driver himself, all of them? Will it expand liability for manufacturers? I think they're going to be looking more at liability for drones and what they may do. Spacecraft. New technologies as compared to new theories. And what old theories measure with these new technologies.
Good. Did you have a follow-up caller?
Did the caller have a follow-up question, it sounded like, maybe?
No, but we do have another question.
Okay, let's go to our next caller then. Go ahead, caller. We might have a technical issue while Laura's trying to sort that out. Let me ask a question if I could. You mentioned the third bill you mentioned. Well, first of all, let me ask if you want to say a little bit more about the likelihood of passage of these three bills in the Senate. They've all passed the House, you've mentioned. You thought it likely that at least one of them would pass. Is one of them, in your view, most critical, most beneficial, most corrective? If you could only pick one, which would you pick?
That would be difficult because they really meet different constituencies in some ways. Probably the one that does the most is the hardest to pass, and that's the Class Action and Litigation Fairness Act, because it's long, it is a lot of it is new, and these bills, it took the Class Action Fairness Act 7 years to pass. I think it is a little bit easier, maybe for Lara, which is less than a page, and also has political dangers in opposing it. I think there's political dangers in somebody opposing Lara. It's not going to defeat somebody, but if a senator votes against a bill that would put a penalty on somebody who brings a frivolous claim against a neighbor, against a little grocery, against a hairdresser, against a restaurant, that's not so good politically. It's not something that restrain somebody's right to sue. So I think that Lara has a little bit of a grassroots catch to it, Dean, because people can understand it. And it's very hard to understand when somebody votes against that. It actually played out a little bit in the last Iowa race for Senate. Remind me who won there. There was a woman who's now a senator, and she ran against a trial lawyer. And he had voted against Lara three times, and she used it against him in debates.
Interesting. That's very interesting. So it sounds like the caller who had a question had his or her own phone on mute. If they want to push the star button and the pound button again, we can come back to that caller. Digging down a little
Senator,
deeper.
Senator Joni Ernst. I'm sorry, I momentarily forgot. She was, but that's she used it in a debate.
Yeah. Digging down a little further on the specifics of these bills, you mentioned the third one, the Fairness and Class Action Litigation Act. The class actions under the act must henceforth have some benefit for class members. I've always been sort of unfond of class action litigation where the attorneys are arguing this is going to benefit society more generally, or it's going to have a punitive effect on the defendant, and that's the real benefit of some class actions, that we're going to correct behavior and correct future behavior by big companies that otherwise won't get corrected. And the argument, I think, goes that big company A will take small bits and pieces out of, you know, 100 plaintiffs or a million plaintiffs or millions of plaintiffs. If nobody has large injuries, large enough to bring a suit to correct that behavior, the behavior goes uncorrected. So if you incentivize lawyers by giving them a third of the recovery or 40% of the recovery, these lawyers can then get to the punitive effect on defendants. I've never been fond of that argument, but it seems to me that argument would be deployed in opposition to the Fairness and Class Action Litigation Act. I wonder if you want to talk about that a little bit.
That's you're right, Dean. That's what they'll say. You need these to save society. But as members of the Federalist Society appreciate and others, it is a legal system we're talking about. For punishing people, we do have the state attorney generals. We have the Attorney General of the United States. The legal system is supposed to be directed at benefiting clients. Clients. And one reason that bill, the Class Action and Litigation Act, may ultimately pass is the same reason, and it was a hidden reason, it was never public, that the act passed in 2005. And that is, most lawyers think of the legal system as a means of benefiting their clients. That's who they're working for. They're not working for society. And if they are, it's supposed to be through what their client receives. And yeah, a $50 claim can't be brought. But the way they settle these cases, the plaintiff's lawyers, is they take some trinket for their client, a nothing, then have money put in a trust. Then they have the money from the trust go to some of their things that they like, maybe a law school with their name on it, and the whole system is abused. So there's going to be a battle over system abuse versus the argument that you made, which is one of their strongest arguments to make in a public arena.
Once again, if you're in the audience, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've still got some time. I can't resist. The audience might not know, but they might not remember from your most recent appearance here on Teleforum, but I certainly remember you do some impressions. So I want to pull some of that out of you and ask let me ask Representative Charles Rangel, who I think is well known to this audience and his voice is well known. Now that you're retired, former Congressman Rangel, would you take a retainer to try and persuade Democrats to support the civil justice reforms that Mr. Schwartz has just outlined and help get them passed into law?
Well, it's been, first of all, I thank you for your respect. I am retired, but still active. And my ways and means of earning things, I was on that committee, by the way, are important. And I would seriously consider undertaking that. But apart from my contingency fee, if you could throw a couple of islands in the Bahamas in, I would be very interested.
Very good. Once again, if you're in the audience, if you'd like to join this conversation, push the star button and the pound button on your phone. I think former Congressman Rangel was well known for his real estate ventures.
Absolutely. I received very little earnings from them. I don't know why such a fuss was made.
Let me talk to maybe a friend of yours, if I could, former President Clinton.
Sure. How are you? Look, how's the Federal Society doing?
We're doing fine. It's
good. That's great. I'm doing great, too. I'm down on Route 7 in the Bonnewe Motel watching. I was trying to get this on the phone, but I was watching something else on the television.
Well, thank you for dialing in. Victor Schwartz mentioned that you signed a tort reform bill. I know you signed more than one, I think. So when you faced fierce opposition from trial lawyers, and I assume you did during that phase of your career, you signed these tort reforms. Can you talk about that a little bit for us?
Yes, I can. Look, I'll be glad to. And I just am the happiest man right now alive. I mean, thank God Almighty I'm free at last. But I remember what happened. I remember exactly what happened because the trial lawyers did lobby me and not to sign anything. Well, I had a guy working for me named Bruce Lindsay. It was like Karl Rove who helped Bush or this fellow who helps Trump now. I never can remember his name. But Bruce Lindsay had taken away my glasses. So when that bill came in front of me, Dean, I thought it said tort reform. And I thought, well, maybe I should be out front on that.
Very good. Let me see. I have a final question for a fictional president, Francis Underwood, from the very popular show House of Cards. How would you, President Underwood, fictional President Underwood, I suppose, how would you handle deep pocket jurisprudence that Victor Schwartz has just outlined?
Claire, could we get the answer to that question in front of me right now? I think what I would do is what I do with a lot of things that come in my way. I would bury it.
Very good. Very entertaining. I don't have any more questions.
Well,
thank you. Let me talk to Victor Schwartz now, if I could.
Yeah, I'm back.
Okay, thank you. We were interrupted a little bit by some interlopers there. Let me make a final call for questions from the audience. If you're in the audience, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your phone. Okay. While we wait and see if anybody else is there, let me just ask one final question. You mentioned this at the outset, but I'm wondering if you can say more about what the mechanisms are, maybe in each bill, on the federalism concern. You acknowledge that tort reform, traditionally the province of the states, the one exception to that would be interstate commerce, pretty well defined. Is there a mechanism in each of these bills to make sure they're actuated only when there is interstate commerce?
I really appreciate that question. And GARA, the General Aviation Revitalization Act, dealt with airplanes, which are regulated at the federal level in every way. Here, you have each one deals solely with the federal courts. They're rules for the federal courts, and Congress is empowered to make rules for the federal courts. And I've heard this. I said, well, Victor, the bill, most of my cases where we get frivolous claims are in state courts, so how does Lara help me? Well, the answer to that is, in a number of states, there's an automatic trigger that when the federal rules change, the state rules change automatically. And even if they don't, if you had a change in the federal rule, it's quite persuasive to people to have the same rule in state and federal courts so you don't have forum shopping. So they adhere to federalism principles because they only apply in federal courts, and Congress is empowered to determine what the rules are on federal jurisdiction, for example, and that really enters into the Protection of Innocent Parties Act, and it's not invading states' rights. There's controversy about, I didn't mention medical liability, which may or may not occur, but there are going to be people who will have to determine whether or not any provisions that limit state-based malpractice claims do or do not impede federalism principles. But I believe that for another day and other people to argue. But I didn't go into that topic because I thought it was something that is separate. These are rules for federal courts.
Right. Very good. We don't have another question from the audience. I wanted to come back to you and just see if you want to take a minute or two to wrap up or express any final thoughts you might have.
Well, I first want to thank you, Dean, and the Federalist Society for providing a forum for people to take action on this. And what is action? Action is saying whether you think it's worth supporting these federal initiatives. Action is importantly for the lawyers especially to spot deep pocket litigation and put it over to Carrie. We started, and I did start, Judicial Hellholes. I named it 13 years ago. According to ATRA, the last time it came out where we named St. Louis the number one judicial hellhole in the United States, it brought about reform. It's bringing about reform in Missouri. And I can't believe it, but their PR people tell me 82 million people had ultimately heard about that report through all the media openings. We're not going to get there with deep pocket jurisprudence, but we can work there because what I've seen in my career is that embarrassment and spotlights are great vehicles for reforming our judicial system. If deep pocket jurisprudence is buried the way Frank Underwood wanted to bury it, we will never get rid of it. And that's why this forum is so important and why I so appreciate the opportunity of mentioning it. I'll mention one other quick deep pocket jurisprudence part of law, and you almost have to go back to law school to remember that you're liable for torts of your employee, but not of an independent contractor. So if I'm moving from Washington, D.C. to Chicago and hire Beacons as my mover and they have an accident, I'm not liable to the person who's injured. But what if Beacons is broke? There are decisions out there that eviscerate the rule that you're not liable for torts of an independent contractor. And where do these decisions arise? Every damn one of them is where the independent contractor was bankrupt. So this concept occurs in a lot of places. It's spider-like. And I want to get, would like to get, the help of people in your group and other groups to spotlight it, because it's not fair to hold somebody who's totally innocent subject to liability. So I thank you. You've given me this forum. Dean does a terrific job. He didn't pay me to say this, but he does. And I like the programs. You're fair. And there's another group, I won't mention it. They have panels, and everybody's on one side. Anybody who's been to a Federalist program knows they hear both sides. They bring in the most effective people on other sides. And the way you, Dean, mentioned what is one of the most important arguments that the other side makes, that's important. Oh, one last thing, and I didn't look at my darn notes. Okay, here you go. A letter goes up to the Hill against Lara, against all these bills, on behalf of the 400,000 members of the American Bar Association. Now, I'm actually a member. I don't know if you are, Dean.
I am not a member.
But a lot of your members are members. They weren't asked. Nobody asked them. They're making an assertion of for 400,000 lawyers. So what I've thought of, if I can get Carrie Silverman to help me, is bring a class action Consumer Protection Act against the American Bar Association for misleading statements in the public realm. That's what I'm thinking about. But if any of you are members of the ABA, write them. Tell them, hey, we never took a position on this. What are you doing? And it does bother me a lot that somebody of a group of which I'm a member is representing me where my view is exactly the opposite. And I think something needs to be done about that. I'm sorry for the ad, but it's not good. It's not right.
It's a good final note, actually. I'm going to this is Dean. I want to thank you, Victor Schwartz, for participating today. This was an unusually entertaining edition of Teleforum, but also very high value in terms of information. So thank you for joining us. I want to thank the audience as well. A quick commercial announcement. Our next Teleforum conference call is scheduled for Monday, the 27th at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. We'll be talking about the Heartland versus Kraft Foods case in the Supreme Court. That's Monday at 3 p.m. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.